Welcome to Popcorn Psychology, the podcast where we watch blockbuster movies and psychoanalyze them. My name is Brittany Brownfield, and I'm a child therapist, and I'm joined by...
My name is Hannah Espinoza-Rimas, and I am a couple and marriage and family therapist.
My name is Ben Stover. I am a individual therapist.
We are all licensed clinical professional counselors, also known as therapists, who practice out of Chicago. Even though we are licensed mental health professionals, this podcast is purely for entertainment purposes and to fulfill our love of dissecting pop culture in all forms. So today we're going to be talking about 50 Shades of Grey. We're going to be addressing the whole trilogy because I know the last movie just came out. Me and Hannah saw it. Ben hasn't, but Ben is also newly experienced the first two movies because he hadn't read or watched any of them prior to us forcing him to.
Correct.
This podcast. And the themes we're going to hit on is toxic relationships and how they are influenced by boundaries, power dynamics, trauma, and also how BDSM is kind of used in these movies, misused in our opinions, to kind of interplay with toxic relationships and bad boundaries and trauma and all that stuff.
They all tie in together.
So, I mean, I'm assuming 50 Shades of Grey is pretty linked into pop culture. A lot of people know what it is. It's about a really rich young man who gets involved with a very young woman. She's like 22 and kind of makes her his, what does it make her? Well, arguably. His kind of like submissive to his dominant. So yes. We'll just go from there. So, Ben, what did you think?
I did not enjoy these movies at all. I will start with that. I thought the second one was infinitely better than the first, but they were still pretty low quality garbage, in my opinion.
Ooh, coming in hot.
The actors' performances were kind of wooden, and they had pretty little chemistry with each other. I didn't buy the love of the century kind of thing that they were going for, and the tropes in the story bothered me inherently. The tropes of like vulnerable, unexperienced girl versus rich, powerful guy who can come in and show her a whole new world, and like how that's like a fantasy, but this is so, it's so distorted, and there's so many themes of toxic relationships in this that I was inherently bothered by it. Like, why is it that we need to further the fantasies of women of being dominated?
Yeah, it definitely romanticizes the concept of when a man truly loves you and wants to take care of you, he like basically dominates and controls you, and the woman then is okay being like pretty submissive to him and just being happy to be there. I think that's what troubled me the most in terms of a toxic relationship or a power dynamic skewed relationship with them, is this constant thing where he kind of does whatever she wants and she's just happy he like likes her. You know, it's just this constant like, oh, I'm so happy to be here, and I can't believe this guy, Christian Grey, is like wasting his time with me, that I'll kind of let him do whatever he wants. It's a lot of her coming really far to him and not much of him coming at all far to her. Like, a lot of times when we talk about like appropriate relationships or equal
healthy
relationships, yeah, that's the
healthy
word, is the couple has to kind of come to a middle together. Compromise and be bringing both of themselves 50-50 into a relationship. And in this one, it is a very obvious case of she's doing like 90 and he's doing 10. And he's only doing that 10 if she's doing 100% of her 90. You know, like he's not really budging at all.
Yeah, he is really, I think he has really black and white ideas about what relationships are, which we know for sure stems from his trauma and his experiences, that he's only had relationships where one person has complete control and you're not allowed to have any say in anything. I think one of the other things that really bothers me that you guys both kind of touched on is how she is just this helpless, useless human being without him.
Yeah.
That her, she doesn't develop, her character doesn't really develop intuition. She continually is in these bad situations, has no awareness that these are bad guys or that the situation might be unsafe. She and the women, and also the women in the stories who should have more intuition, even her mother, for instance, none of the women are backing each other up. This is very like, she's alone. Like, if you had a friend who was going through, her friend in the story, you had a friend who was going through this kind of relationship, you'd be like, hey, this doesn't seem okay. And nobody in the story, there's all these red flags, and no woman in the story is able to say, do anything about it.
Well, I guess one thing we can address is, what do we as therapists consider the red flags of this relationship? I think we touched upon one, which is, well, the one, she doesn't really have autonomy, independence. Like, he's constantly buying up, almost like financially buying her autonomy. He buys her a car without asking her. He buys her job, like, in a big way. He buys, like, the whole corporation her job is, like, an arm of. He gives her money against her consent.
Yep.
Like, and he power plays her a lot with that. Like, the scene where she says no, rips up the checkup, and then he calls the bank in front of her in this very, like, dominating move. And puts the money in her account. He buys a house without asking her in the third movie. It's just all these ways for him to have complete financial control over her life.
Yeah, she doesn't have a say in anything, because it makes it seem like she's not allowed to. She's not smart enough to be able to make those kinds of decisions. Only he can make those decisions for her.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't think that any of that showed a loving relationship. Now, I know that one of the things I want to make sure I cover is that I know that there are different lifestyles that people live. And True. That people Absolutely. Choose to live. And that's okay. And sometimes it takes an introduction to get into that world before you know whether it's right or not for you. And that takes some experimentation and some figuring out and some being introduced to things. However, the way that these movies kind of showed those things showed predatory behavior by him, like selecting extreme. A target, and that bothered me. I selected this girl who was out of her element, out of a city, brought her to a new city to live with him before she'd seen the world. Like, she was a college student, and when he first met her,
like,
a virgin,
no sex, right. Like, he's introducing everything to her, and, like, everything she's experiencing is through his narrative, what he's telling her it's about. He's shaping, like, everything. I mean, it's very predatory. The fact that, I mean, we talked about this off mic, but the fact that he, with her, and then it sounds like that girl who has mental health problems in the second movie, who kind of, like, stalks him.
Right.
Like, he, both those and probably the other ones, it sounds like he continues to choose women who are not part of the BDS community to have these relationships with, which, when you really think about it, makes no sense. Because from what little I know about BDSM is, it's kind of like a sexual orientation. Like, either you're into it or you're not. And so for him to just pluck women off the street and kind of talk them into being into BDSM, and then it's still being on his terms, is very predatory behavior. It's all about, and kind of what you said too is, Hannah, is there are multiple points in the movie where she is obviously very distressed. Like, she's on the phone to somebody and she's crying, but then she's minimizing it. And I can't remember the exact moment, but there is that moment where she's, like, really upset. Like, I don't...
She's talking to her mom.
She's
talking to her mom, and her mom, for the 10 seconds in the whole goddamn whole set of all the movies, is like, hey, you don't sound okay. And she still doesn't think, in my opinion, doesn't have the right to be like, no, something, I feel bad. She visibly feels bad. She's upset. She called her mom to talk to her, but then ends up not feeling like she can tell her anything because Christian made her promise that she couldn't say anything.
Well, because
that he can have, again, all the control of the narrative, because his narrative has been the same, set up in the same way, where when he was 15, it was the secret, because it had to be a secret from his family and from his mother, because the relationship was completely inappropriate and predatory in a similar way.
Well, I mean, he follows her to Georgia, wherever her mom lives. He follows her to there without asking, and, like, forces her mom to meet him.
Yep.
So that's very controlling. When she finally puts her foot down in the first movie and says, I don't want to do this contract, I don't think I can do this, I don't think BDSM is for me, he breaks into her apartment. That blows my mind. Every time I've watched that movie, I'm just like, how is... The fact that she does not at any point, before or after the sex, says, how did you get in here and what made you think that's okay, is so toxic. Not just that in the realm of this relationship, but the message it's sending to all the people, all the women watching these movies, is this man, just because he's hot and young has money. And has a bunch of money means that he can literally do whatever he wants, and you should be grateful because he's hot and young and has a lot of money. Like, I think that to me was the biggest, like, red flag of these, well, there's a lot, but of these movies, of the first one, is the fact that he breaks, as soon as she tries to stand up for herself, he breaks into her apartment, dominates her. And also, I mean, I'm gonna be reading into a little bit, like, has sex with her doggy style, which is also a very dominating move.
Yeah.
And so I think it's all this, and he ties her up, and it's just this whole, like, I have to have you, you're not allowed to be any part of that. Once I've decided that I want right. you to be mine, that's that.
Which is an abusive relationship way to think about it. Mm-hmm. That he has to have mm-hmm. all of the control, and he has to be the one. She's not allowed to be with anybody else. She's not allowed to make a decision on her own. He has to control everything, which is what happens when women experience abuse, when anyone experiences abuse, is taking all the power away from them, and how that kind of falls into the power dynamic, which is also another big problem in this relationship, is that there's no, he has all the power all the time,
and he's making her bit by bit more financially dependent on him, which is a big abuser move.
Correct.
And like, all the stuff that he buys, especially when they get married, like, she can't continue that lifestyle. That lifestyle's bonkers. Like,
yeah.
And, ugh, yeah. And then also stuff like when he, in the first movie, when she gets drunk and calls him, he takes her to his apartment and he undresses her and changes her. That is very bad boundaries. Like, why wouldn't he take her to her apartment or call one of her friends and be like, hey, she's really drunk? And at that point, they haven't even had sex yet. They're not even dating.
Nothing. She just drunk dials his ass. And he comes and picks her up. Like, all of those things. If there was anybody that I was in any kind of relationship with, like, as a friendship, and they were like, yeah, so I drunk dialed this guy, and then he showed up where I was, and he punched the guy I was with, I would be like, girl, you need to get away from him.
Like, you're not even dating him yet.
You're not even dating him, and he's already stalking you, basically. Like, that is a really, I think any time that somebody knows where you are, and they shouldn't, is a red flag. Automatically.
Or when they...
Clearly.
Or when they assume so much part in your life. Like, the fact that he barely knows her, and he's already like, this is the role I'm supposed to be doing.
I'm going
to
take care of you. You need somebody to take care of you, and I'm going to do it. And I'm the one who's going to say that I'm the one who can do it. I'm the only one.
And I think why that's so troublesome, like, bringing it into, like, a therapist perspective is, I think, and this movie is a very, very, the biggest example of it, is a lot of people romanticize this behavior of, look how much he cares about me. Look how he treats me well. He takes care of me. He'd never let anything happen to me. Like, a lot of people we work with in these kind of negative relationships do a lot of work for themselves, reframing it into these very, like, romanticized ways in order to deal with all the red flags that they're probably at some level of their anatomy, intuitively, whatever, are feeling, but they can't face it. Especially in, like you said, these situations where all your friends and family are being like, he's such a great guy. You're so lucky that he's with you. I can't believe he can afford to buy you a car. Like, nobody is being like, what the fuck?
At right. any point. He sold your car? What do you mean he sold your car?
You can sell a car? Without... Yeah.
Sorry. When you're rich and white, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's a few things that we want to make sure that we cover when we talk about this movie. There's a few categories we identified, and we're going to move through them as we go through this today. So we want to cover, as we've started a little bit, to talk about toxic relationships and include boundaries and power dynamics. That's something that we want to cover is huge. When we say words like red flags, they're jargon that we're using that indicates warning signs to you that something isn't right here, something isn't normal, something should be indicative to you that this could be an abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. We also want to be sure that we cover trauma and some of the norms of the BDSM culture, and make sure that we're covering an aspect of this that explains what that world is really like, and how people choose to live that lifestyle, and how that can be negotiated, and how they have a motto within that culture that if you do any research on it at all, you find out that, you know, there's three rules that they always want to maintain is, like, smart, safe, and sane.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel like those things were used in that movie at all. And that's a pretty important part. And then we're going to move into talking about treatment for some of the characters, because there are some things that the characters experienced in their life that we feel like would be representative of needing treatment.
So, in terms of power dynamics, what are other things? Is there other things that you noticed, Ben, as our sole male interpreter of this series?
So, some of the things that I noticed that I had big issues with are the we said already, the predatory behavior, but also the isolating. He moved her to a new city, and then quickly moved her in with him, and had her sign a non-disclosure agreement at their first date, which, with people who are in the public eye, sometimes that's not uncommon for them to do, to not have to have a non-disclosure agreement about their relationship and such, like to protect their public image. Like, that's not inherently a wrong thing, but it should be like a warning sign to you that something might be off here. But then when he's talking about like some of the rules that he has, I don't sleep with people, you know, like this can be your room, you can decorate this however you want, but then you have to stay here. Also like wanting to not let her take work trips and be protective of her.
You can go to New York with me
Stay with me. Like, she was supposed to do this for her career. Now, granted, the guy turned out to be...
Which I hate that got proved right.
I did too. I really hated that, because then it's going to validate everything. Now, like, that guy's role in the story, of course, had to expand and grow from there. But that guy was, you know, he was clearly a creep. And he also represented some abusive relationship and boundary power dynamic problems. Because it's not just relationships you can see those in. You can see those in work, where someone starts offering quid pro quo. That's not okay. Like, there shouldn't be any pressure on anyone to, like, well, you know, you sleep with someone to get ahead. Like, any kind of pressure like that, I mean, not only is it illegal, but it's...
Yeah.
It's something that is wrong and will never actually result in you getting the respect and, you know, gain forward you want to get. And I'm glad that we've seen a lot of that get exposed and crushed now with the Me Too movement. But, like, as far as other, like, power dynamics, you see this... Like, taking away her consent and trying to get her to agree to things like, you know, the, you know, sexual activity we have will be whatever I determine I need.
Yeah. Like, you're kind of like a vessel that I will utilize. I mean, he kind of treats her like a living sex toy, if you really want to get that.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, frank about it. And I think a big power dynamic, too, is it's very push-pull. Even in the constructs of him being... quote unquote, very black and white about what he will and won't do. He does this constant, like, I'm going to kiss you, but we can't be together. Like, I don't have vanilla sex, but I very tenderly help you lose your virginity. Like, I don't fall in love, but I also am in love with you. Like, it's this very, like, giving her a little bit, taking it away, giving it, taking it away. He's not even
attachment.
Yeah, he's not even being.
It's an attachment issue, right?
Yeah, and he's not, but he's not even, he's keeping her.
Like, on her toes.
Like unbalanced, because keeping even though confused. He's presenting this very black and white, what I can and can't offer you, but then he gives her, which I think is a big manipulation tactic we see in relationships, which is I give you just enough to make you think it could be something more, but then I take it away and I'm very adamant about what I'm taking away or what I can't do. So that
and why it's your fault.
And why the other person
and that
can't
you did
ever
something
feel like,
to make me act this way.
Yeah. And I think I've seen that a lot with relationships. I mean, as a therapist, but also as, like, a human woman, like, talking to other people about, well, he did this, or she did this, so I think that it could be this. And that's kind of a more subtle power dynamics thing.
Yeah.
Of not really being clear with the other person, but giving them a little bit of what they want. I mean, it's emotional abusive tactic.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
But I love you, baby, but I can't do that.
And another thing about it that, like, bothered me and plays into that is... Like, he would use his money and power to, like, wow her and show her, like, this whole new world you can have with me if you surrender this. You know, like, if you surrender yourself to me, you can have this.
Taking her on that fancy trip, showing her that...
Well, a helicopter.
The helicopter, and then that weird, whatever that...
Glider?
Glider thing? I don't know what it is. Yeah. Go ahead. I interrupted you.
No, it's okay. Like, but like showing her like all these experiences on this, wow, like, and if you do this, you can have all these things. But all the things you're telling me that you want from a relationship, you can't have any of those. Or you can, we can have that one day a week.
Ugh. And then when she, and we haven't even touched upon the whole whipping at the end of the first movie where he seriously hurts her and seriously looks like he's getting off on really hurting her. And then she pulls away from him, says, this isn't what I want, which would have been a great way to end that whole story. Like, a healthy way. Like, I tried this. I'm now being very clear with myself that I, regardless of how I feel about you, I can't give you what you want.
Yeah.
Because this is it. And, but then folds immediately. I mean, arguably the whole movie series, book series, takes place over a few months, a few weeks.
Yeah, it's not that long. It's not that long.
So, in these moments where she puts her foot down and then she goes back to him, it's days. Yeah. And it's also in the context of these very grand controlling gestures. Like, he goes to that art exhibit and buys all the pictures of her because no one can look at you but me. And then she's so, I don't know, blown away by that, that she takes him back.
Yeah.
On, and yeah. And then, but she and continues to let him do little things to reiterate their previous relationship dynamics.
Right.
Which is also very common when you work with people who are in unhealthy relationships.
Yes.
There's this very subtle way of falling back into it. Like, you have to be very firm, which is very hard, with your in yourself about what are deal breakers, what aren't deal breakers, what are my boundaries, what are my personal lines, and putting your foot down about it. And I think if we're going to get to the next part of it, what Hannah touched upon a little bit in the beginning is Christian, when he's very young, 15, I guess we can go back, is he was traumatized. He was raised by a woman who, he calls her, I think, a crack whore, which is horrible. Woman who, a drug addicted, sex worker, who probably had a really hard life and who drug overdosed. And so he was found, he was adopted by his very rich family. And so he probably had a lot of stuff going on that we don't really know about between like that time and 15. And then at 15, I guess he's an angry kid. So he kind of describes it. His mother's adult friend forms a sexual relationship with him, a brown BDSM, and kind of ties his trauma, ties his sexuality
together
to these unhealthy relationships, his unhealthy power dynamics, and kind of forms his whole sexuality around the power dynamics of BDSM and kind of perverts the whole situation. And I think what's mind-blowing to me, I'm sure to all of us as therapists, as mandated reporters, which just means we have to report to the authorities about abuse, is that this relationship, for the most part in these books, is treated like no big deal. Like, not like the intense trauma it is.
Right. It's child abuse.
It's child abuse.
It's straight up child abuse. Statutory rape.
Yeah, he's not of age to give consent, which, again, is another way that this movie, nobody cares about consent in this movie. It's not talked about. It's mm-hmm. not ever serious. They just, every, no one, like, mm-hmm. Christian didn't have the ability to give consent either.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, I mean, the only real part we know about his abuse as a little kid is he was hurt a lot, like, physically burned by cigarettes and stuff.
Yes.
So, when she was, when Miss Robinson, as they call her, was being sexual with him, within these BDSM realms, she's recreating trauma for him by physically hurting him because he's the submissive in that relationship.
Correct.
So whether he was cognizant of it or not, like realizing it, she was re-traumatizing by continuing to abuse him and also muddling it in with his sexuality and making him feel like he was a complicit part of that relationship.
Right. And it became a part of his identity.
Oh, in a real way, which is a very common thing with people that are sexually abused as children, as teenagers, is your sexuality being really thrown around and complicated and kind of warped and rearranged and discombobulated in your head.
Right. And it can lead to a pattern of recreating trauma as a way that, which can happen for a couple reasons. It can be the only way that people now understand sexuality in this really kind mm-hmm. of sadly warped way. And it can also be a way of reestablishing control over their life by recreating the trauma but taking on the role of the abuser.
Mm-hmm.
And then that is a way to like relieve anxiety and get back in control of a situation.
I mean, I think that's an excellent point, and I didn't think about that till now, and I'm sure E.L. James didn't think about this when she was writing these books, is that it's a classic thing of you are abused, and then when you grow up, you become the abuser, because it's a way for you to control the situation. He went from being the submissive with Miss Robinson to being the dominant. And how black and white he thinks those roles have to be for a relationship to exist. Like, even in the second movie, when he's finally willing to, like, compromise with Anastasia, it's in the context of he submits to her. Like, he gets down on his knees and is like, does the whole submissive move, because right. in his poor mind, you either are the dominant or you are the submissive. And if Anna can't deal with him being the dominant, then he will concede to being her submissive. And what she tries to do, which is one of the small good things, is she gets down on her knees and she says, that's not how I want this to be. It doesn't have to be one of us is the dominant, one of us is submissive for us to function.
Well, in his narrative, that is the only way that he's experienced what he thinks mm-hmm. is a healthy relationship or love, is all or nothing. There yeah. isn't any gray area. I could know myself, guys. there isn't any gray area in this, in for him, in the way yeah. that a relationship can be. He can only see it in this way.
Which I think is really common when doing work with people therapeutically. Like, they get really stuck in when you've had unhealthy relationships, trauma, abuse, is there is such clearly defined roles for everybody to keep yeah. these unhealthy systems going, that to try to flip it or to try to get them to get an understanding that there is flexibility and you don't have to be one thing or the other can feel really unsafe.
Absolutely.
And really uncomfortable, because then... because there's no, like you said, there's no intuition, there's no just adaptability.
There's no chance for them to build mm-hmm. a different way of looking at things. So it's mm-hmm. just, and you have to make those experience, and part of what we do in therapy, which we can talk about more in treatment, is helping them realize mm-hmm. what is safe, what does feel safe for mm-hmm. you. And because everybody has different boundaries and everybody has different ways that they deal with different things. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, we can talk about that more when we get to treatment.
Yeah, and something that we want to be like sure to highlight is, like, when people are in these abusive relationships, there's a clearly defined cycle of abuse that happens.
Yeah.
And this movie shows it a little bit, but you can see where people, like, I go through kind of like a neutral period where things are okay.
And you're just
kind
of kicking it.
And just okay. Then there starts to be some rising tensions and things start to get a little more uncomfortable. Boundaries start to be pushed, broken, etc. Then it rises. There's like a climactic action, almost like a story pattern, like where the abuse happens. Then there's this period of cooling down, then a honeymoon period. And then the cycle starts all over again, where things mm-hmm. go back into the things are okay. So it can go from, like, things are fairly calm and normal. Things start to go a little bad, but they're still within the acceptable range. An incident happens, then violence or abuse of some sort occurs. Mm-hmm. Then typically there's some sort of shame or apology by the abuser, which
we do see in these movies.
Which we do see.
Multiple times.
But there comes, like, grand gestures of mm-hmm. apology and I'll change and things can be different and things mm-hmm. can be better. I can be different. But
it won't happen again.
I want to marry you now.
Right.
Let's get married.
You've showed me a different way and now I feel like I can be different with you because you're the only one that I can be different
with.
Yeah,
like, you're the only one that can touch my chest. If we're going to get specific with these movies.
Which is one of the only trauma things that they get right, is that it would make sense that someone who experienced intense physical abuse would have certain areas on their body yes. that might be very hard to be touched.
Yes. I remember even reading the books being impressed by that part.
Yeah.
But that part alone.
But then they shit on it.
Immediately.
So he does the outline with the lipstick, but then she's allowed to wash it off. Which she goes completely out of the boundaries when she's washing him off in the shower.
Correct.
And then, P.S., in the third fucking movie, it's fine. He's fine. She can just touch his chest and it's no big deal. She walks up to him, gives him a hug, puts her hands on his chest and rub up to his shoulders. And I'm just like, you gotta be kidding me. The fact that love automatically fixes past trauma, severe physical abuse, It's just not true, and it's not fair to tell people that that is true, and that's what's really hard about watching these movies.
Right, if you loved me enough, your trauma would not be as big a barrier in our relationship, and that's not fair.
She really, that's the only thing, I mean, she does a lot of things that I'm not okay with, but in terms of her not being kind to him, is she's really pushy about that chess thing, and really uninsightful about how, I mean, she's young, I guess I can get it. She's, like, not in the therapeutic world, but, like, it's that thing where she's like, why can't I do it? Why won't you let me have that piece of you? Because I think what, in healthy, when you're in a relationship with someone who has had trauma or abuse, there might always be parts of them that they cannot give you 100% or that they need to keep for themselves. And that's okay.
Yes.
You don't need to have everything of the other person to be in love, to be healthy in love, and
to have a partner that you can share your life with. You don't have to give all of yourself ever.
And I think this movie is that personified. Like, you have to give everything to each other, and you have to concede a lot of stuff and be okay with that. And that's how you show love to each other.
Right. And that's not accurate, and it's not fair. And sometimes with relationships, like even with a therapeutic relationship with someone, we in like the most intimate type of relationship that you can have was in a, like, it's not sexually intimate, like personally intimate, is sometimes you don't even have that with your partner, but you might have with a therapist or a provider where you are in a space where you are safe and you can tell your deepest, darkest secrets without being judged.
Well, because we have no personal gain in it.
Right.
Like, we're not trying to be in a relationship with you. We're not trying to have sex with you. We're not trying. It doesn't matter how we feel about you personally. And that can be very freeing in those situations. Because there's not going to be any personal consequence.
Because I think no matter how you look at it, when you have something to gain, even in the smallest way, it doesn't feel like you can be 100% honest with anyone. No matter how much you love the other person, or even if it is a good relationship, it's really hard to feel not judged in some way. And a therapist relationship that's what's really unique, and that's part of really why it works.
Right. And even in that setting, with those types of boundaries where you are going to be accepted for who you are no matter what, we call it, you know, like unconditional positive regard that we will hold for our clients. It's something that your therapists hold on to strongly. It's part of what makes the therapeutic alliance, which is the relationship between therapist and client, work. And even in that setting, where we have that kind of relationship, where you will not be judged, you are held in the most positive light, just assuming that you did the best you could given the information that you had. And that's okay. We'll work with you from there going forward. But even in that space, therapists don't push people.
Oh, 100%. That's
talk
true.
About more than they are ready to do.
Yeah.
Like, and that's part of what makes it work. Like, even in the most intensive trauma treatments, we give clients stop signals, much like the safe words used in this movie that are not used in realistic ways. But clients are given the ability to go, like, you know what, this is a boundary. This is a hard line. Like, I can't do this right now. And that's okay.
Oh, yeah,
it's always okay.
I think a lot of times what people are scared to go into therapy is because I think they assume, and I get it, that the therapist is going to be like, you've decided to come here, so now you need to share with me all of your deepest, darkest secrets, and I can't help you until you do that. And that we're not going to have any boundaries with them.
Yeah.
Because you've decided to come to therapy. And I think what people get really surprised about when I work with them, and I'm sure you guys have the same experience, is that I don't expect them to do that.
No.
Is that I tell them, I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions, and you can tell me if you're not okay with talking about it. Or I'll tell people we don't have to get into that today, or we can stop. And I think that really shocks people in a hopefully a positive way when they go to see therapists.
Yeah, I find myself telling people things like, I am here to help you.
Mm-hmm.
This is whatever feels the best for you right now is what we're going to focus on. If we can't talk about that today, that's okay. We can talk about other stuff. And then I am here to help you in the best way. So if this doesn't feel like this is working, then let's try something else. Because there are so many different ways that I can help you.
Right.
It doesn't have to be in this one way where you have to, again, give me everything in order to get my help or to get, like, you don't have to do that.
Right. And then what bothered me about, like, the way this movie showed that, particularly with those red lines of lipstick on his chest and how quickly that got resolved and, like, violated.
Don't
she violated
you know
his
that
boundaries.
Love heals all mental health issues, Ben? Haven't you watched movies?
I God, I haven't watched enough of them. Like, you know, according to movies, also, you know, we always have sex with all our clients, too. Ugh. So, you know, that's...
I can't even get to... Well,
That's a whole other...
That's a whole other thing.
That's a whole other podcast we're going to do soon. Time. But that... the things that are misrepresented is that, like, this... That love can overpower... These traumatic situations, love can overpower. If you just love me enough, then you'll be able to get past your issues. And that's not fair, accurate, or true. And I don't like the way that was handled in these movies where he set a firm boundary of that, like, and showed, like, this is where you can touch me. And she, like, immediately, like, went past that. And he was just like, okay. And, like, it was all healing for him to have, like, That may happen in a relationship somewhere down the line, but that could take years or never.
Yeah, and it also would be very. Okay. It would also be very incremental, I would imagine. Like you can touch this much of my chest, or you can touch this much of my chest for like 30 seconds on a good day. You know, like, and we'd have to frame it around me doing like some. Like self-care coping skills right after or right before. Like it would be very
like I'm gonna need something structured. Very specific after this, and like I might have to be alone for a little while. I may need to see my therapist. Like it would not be resolved in, oh, she let me do whatever I wanted, or she loves me now, and so now it's fine.
Because it makes me wonder if it's presented like once he like rips that Band-Aid off of her touching his chest, he's like, oh, that wasn't too bad. I can keep doing that, which isn't really how that goes.
Not usually.
When something is a unsafe space on your body, it doesn't just become a safe space. It's not in your head in that once someone finally touches it, oh, okay, it's going to get demystified and you're going to be cool. It's usually very almost re-traumatizing for the person if they're not in the right headspace. And it also has to be very consent oriented going back to that. Like, if this was portrayed more healthy, it would be that she probably would have to ask before she touched his chest every time.
Absolutely.
Hey, can I put my hand on your chest? It'll be my right hand going. I mean, it would be not is very
sexy.
Is
the pressure okay? Is this too much? Is this too hard? Like, there's a lot. It would be very slow, and it would be very intentional and consent-oriented, like we said.
And, I mean, switching that back into the BDSM stuff, flipping it into how BDSM is portrayed in this movie is the consent on his part with her, which is he doesn't check in with her during the acts of BDSM in the movie. They don't really talk about her safe word until the third movie, and that's we can't even get to that whole scenario in this podcast. But
no,
it's just there's no real checking in, taking baby steps, especially since he is working with being with someone who is brand new to the BDS community. Like, there's no baby steps checking in or easing her into it, really.
Right. Like, he talks with her about this contract. Like, this is something that bothered the hell out of me, is that, like, it's not, like, an accurate representation of how the culture of the BDSM community typically works. And when we say BDSM, I realize that not everybody knows what that means. So that stands for bondage, domination, and sadomasochism, is what that stands for when we say that. And there's people who are engaged in one part of that or all of it. Not everybody is engaged all or nothing with it. People are comfortable with different parts of it. Some people are comfortable with it just during sex or what they sometimes scenes, which can be not even non-sexual, at least not with like pure sexual contact. They can get pleasure out of that, but we can talk more about that in a bit. The thing that with the BDSM culture that I felt was violated and done wrong was that he brought up this contract, but was still having, like, kink sex kinds of things with her. Before they signed it. Before they agreed to it.
Did she ever really sign it? No, she never signs it.
She never signs it.
Never signed it.
And so she really doesn't have... I mean, I guess he's gambling with her mouth, like, her running around and talking about it, but...
I know, that's right. Well, she signed the non-disclosure.
Oh, did she sign
And at this point, she doesn't have any money to go to a lawyer if he fucking sued her.
Well, right. I think... Anyway, I mean, we're interrupting you, Ben. But also, the fact that it creates an environment where she can't even talk to her friends and family about parts of their relationship. Because talking about your sexual relationship with your friends and your... peers is like, and especially when you're discovering it, is really important.
I digress. It's important. And then people also, like, as another part of like an abusive relationship, a keynote part of an abusive relationship is isolating people away from their supports so that you become the abuser, becomes their world and their truth. It's called gaslighting. Like, their truth becomes the only truth. And they
like,
would...
why are you acting crazy right now, baby?
Right.
Well, you're being so crazy. That's like a the go-to example of gaslighting.
Right.
Yes, like making you think like you're being bananas.
Right. Yes. Girl on the Train highlighted that so well. We can talk about that later. But that's that kind of thing. Like, it bothered me a lot because I mean, she did verbally essentially agree. They went through the negotiation in the first movie, but like she went through and she set her boundaries on like which things are okay when they went through this contract, but it wasn't like she had a role in creating that. It was his wants and what he's okay with, and there was almost like pressure from him to go through things that like she wasn't comfortable with. Like when they started talking about fisting, that was one of the things where like where she said a hard no on, and he was like, "Really? Are you sure?"
Yeah, there's no just accepting what she's saying. And also, I think I just keep going back to the fact that there's no explicit conversation in this, in the books, in the movies, if she even likes this stuff. If she even likes it.
Right.
Like, that seems to be a non-issue. If she even likes this kind of sex. Or being put in pain. And stuff like that. And I mean, but it's a way for him to kind of make BDSM, he utilizes it as almost like a way to recreate his trauma.
Right.
You know, and not so much as a sexual practice.
Which is one of the other things that is they show in the movies and the books is that in order to enjoy BDSM, you have to have had trauma in your history.
That is probably, I would imagine, as I'm not a part of the BDSM community, but I would imagine as being part of it, that would be really infuriating, is this movie does create the narrative that in order for us people who are reading the books who aren't part of it to understand why he would be into something like this is obviously it was because he was traumatized. Like, it does create that narrative of in order to like pain during sex, you must have been fucked with at some point in your life.
Right. Yeah, there has to be some degree of it.
That's there's something wrong with you if you like BDSM.
And the way it's presented is very, like, trauma and BDSM sexuality are very enmeshed in these movies.
Yes.
Like, with Miss Robinson, with the way he does it with Anna, you know, the fact that he has to have trauma to be into BDSM, like, it makes it very, like, intermingled. Like, you can't have one without the other, which is not how it is.
Right.
And very disrespectful, I can imagine, for the BDSM community.
Right. And, like, I've heard differing perspectives on this. I watched a documentary on it when I was doing research for this, so I wanted to be prepared. But I mean, one of the things that I watched was the people that they were interviewing generally had a opinion that the movies and the books were a good thing for the community by bringing it in more of the mainstream and allowing it to be something that was, it was okay, and it was, like, not as taboo. Like, it's still a different world that comes with a different set of rules, but, and can be very erotic for people, but the way the movie and the book kind of went through it was a good introduction to some stuff, but it didn't capture, like, the true nature of the world. And I felt like that was, people were getting like really into these books and were really turned on by them and really enjoyed it. But some of the stuff in there, like with just, it wasn't represented the way things tend to actually go and how the culture of the community goes. It's its own community, and they have their own set of culture, their own set of rules, their own like roles language. That people play,
and
their own
book,
language.
And this movie and books picked from it, just like picked and choosed.
Yep.
Like, just kind of stealed from it a little bit. Like, the parts that fit its narrative. And the fact that as the movies evolve and the books evolved, like, he gets less and less. The sex gets more and more, quote-unquote, regular and vanilla. Because he, it creates this idea that the more he works through his trauma, the less he needs to be involved in BDSM sex. Which is not true.
Right. It's not true at all. And it also bothered me that, like, they kind of tried to, like, blend it for him. Like, some people do, like, operate this. So there's different ways that this culture can operate. There are some people that operate, like, in a slave-master type of relationship, and that's just the lifestyle they choose to live. And that's okay.
Yeah.
If everybody is consenting and agreeing, and they know what they're getting into, and they have set rules, and that's what they want, that's okay. If you choose to live your life that way, that, I mean, fine. Your friends and family probably will have issues and not understand it, but you can also find a new community that does and has a full appreciation for it. But with this type of situation, like that they showed in these movies, it didn't cover any of the negotiation, the rule setting, the fact that like many of these things tend to operate as what they call scenes, where they have pre-negotiated rules for what's going to happen in this scene. They talk about what they're going to do, and so they go through the whole scenario that they set up with what toys or what types of bondage or commands or scenarios are going to be okay, and then they go through the scene, and then you know, like whether or not sex can be a part of that even is also typically negotiated. Someone that I used to work with was very involved in this community and gave us a pretty thorough education on how this the culture of this world works, and it is very, very different than
what sounds 50 really, Shades represented. Really highly structured.
Yes.
Like, she's constantly not aware of what's going to happen to her.
Right.
Which is really scary. If we're going to talk about women and consent and sexual empowerment, that's terrifying.
Yep.
And the fact that there are no rules, it would have been cool if at some point later in the movies, they would have had a revisiting of what she liked and didn't like in the bedroom. But I think people think that's not sexy or whatever. But I think what's ironic about BDSM to people that are outside of the community is that it's such a highly structured situation.
And that consent is given, not only do they talk about it and make sure that everything is okay and have a plan, but it's also in the moment. Like, if something is new that maybe you haven't tried before, knowing your partner or the person that you're engaging with BDSM in, knowing them really well and being able to help from their bodies, from their body language, like, maybe I need to check in with them. Like, consent was such a... I read a book that is over there somewhere that I can't find. There it is. Called As Kinky As You Want to Be, Your Guide to Safe, Sane, and Smart BDSM by Shanna Germain. And it has a lot of really good information in it, especially if you're really like the 50 Shades books and wanted information on what it really would look like. And it had a lot of good information in it, but also mostly talked about how to be safe for everybody. And how important that is, and how important consent is. How that's such a main point in the community.
And just, I mean, the scene at the end of the first movie, when he really, really hurts her, when he whips her and she's crying, and she doesn't use her safe word, which is infuriating.
Yeah.
And that whole situation is... My concern would be that the general population reading this book, watching these movies, thinks that that is the real intent of BDSM. Like, because that's where he looks like he's getting the most off, which is not okay, is really genuinely wanting to hurt someone and make them cry and make them upset. And that scene is a totally not BDSM. That was abuse. That was straight up trauma recreation and abuse. And I mean, we haven't even talked about the fact that he picks women that look like his mom. We haven't even touched upon that. I mean, which I guess we could argue might be the biggest red flag, or one of the biggest red flags of this whole relationship.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know. I mean, this is me just having an opinion, but hearing that from a partner and then just being like, oh, okay, is mind-boggling.
The way that she just blows off the fact that she's looking at a picture, she realizes that she looks like this person, and it's just not a big deal at all.
Like, they have a couple convos, but, like, it gets pretty blown through pretty quickly.
Yeah, it really does. And then the fact that, like, this other woman who's got mental illness and got, had suicidality and self-injury, who, like, ends up stalking him in the second movie. Lola, Lily?
Something like that.
I don't remember her name.
It's with an L, I think.
Lila,
yeah. But then, like, the way they depicted her bothered me to my core about the depiction of mental illness and how...
ill people are dangerous.
Right. And some people are dangerous. But the way they depicted her, like, is just... Like, somebody... her husband died, and then she...
Yeah, something like that. But also, I think... really bad. Just the thing where... being involved in a BDSM relationship will make you like her. Will make you lose your mind.
Right. Again,
which, like, was kind of I might have been reading in that too much, but like that kind of idea, like she was the natural consequence, like almost like the morality story for Anna of if you keep going like this with this guy and you let him be BDSM with you and stuff, you're going to end up like this girl, because the only way to leave this relationship is to lose your mind.
Right, and like, and they had hinted at that, like, with her, which I also, frankly, should have been a red flag, was that, like, what did he say? He had, like, there'd been, like, 17 subs, like, in his...
I believe so. Or 16-something. It's close.
It's a large number of people for someone that's 27.
Yeah.
Oh, dang.
He goes through them. He goes through them pretty fast, because that's, like, a couple a year. If he started when he was, like, 17.
Well, he said he was the sub for this woman for 5 years.
Okay, so then he was...
So he was at least 20. So this is
7 years he blew through 17 women who look like his mom. Oh, God.
So, I mean, this should be warning that there's trauma recreation here, and...
Yeah.
Like, that he was preyed upon, and now he's preying upon people. But when they showed that natural consequence point, it was a good one. Like, they showed that, like, if you go on this path, like, you'll end up like her. And that bothered me because, for a couple reasons, the depiction of her. Like, one, mentally ill folks aren't all dangerous. Like, the only predictor of violence is past violence. Having a mental illness does not necessarily make you violent. There are many people who have mental illness who are... no more likely to hurt you than anyone else.
Well, more often than not, they're the victims of the violence.
That's also true. Particularly, the more chronic your mental illness gets, the more likely you are to have trauma.
To be victimized.
To be victimized, and seriously victimized. Mm-hmm. But also, with the way they kind of just glossed over, like, what it takes to get her help. I mean, like, yeah, he did say, like, yeah, we got her to a hospital where she's supposed to, like, where she needs to be. But
this whole movie, this whole universe operates in the fantasy of having a lot of money and being able to use that money to make problems go away.
Right.
And, I mean, and I guess that, I mean, that could be a real life issue with someone like Christian Grey, where he struggles to grow or change because a lot of his life, he doesn't have a lot of natural consequences that keep him from getting what he wants.
It could be, yeah.
Because a lot of times when we work with people, where we get kind of like a barrier is that there's nothing really interrupting their life because they have resources of some kind. But
were you going to talk about how hard it would have been to get her into the hospital since she...
I mean, I don't think it would have been hard. No. Like, we knew that she had...
gun, she was threatening, she was stalking, she broke into her house, she slit her wrist. Didn't she escape from a hospital?
No, I don't think so.
She still had bandages on her.
Yeah, she did.
Did she escape from a hospital? Yeah, that shit doesn't happen. Like, that doesn't happen. Like,
that doesn't happen like it happens in the movies, where everyone's just escaping the hospital.
Yeah, they're escaping the hospital. Like, you're not escaping the hospital. Like, there's staff everywhere, the doors are locked, you're not going anywhere. You'd have to get through so many doors. Like, it doesn't exist like that. And the way mental hospitals are portrayed also bothers the hell out of me, but that's a whole nother topic. Because most mental hospitals, like, exist in the movies, don't exist at all anymore.
They don't.
But the thing with her that, like, really just bothered me was that there was no one keeping track of this woman, like, and she could just appear in... be just this incredible victim of the situation. And they showed her, like, immediately submitting back to him and falling back into the old patterns. It was gross.
I mean, I liked that it took Anna a bit aback, the situation.
Right.
Like, she saw what happened. She was like, I don't know about this. I mean, it lasted like 5 seconds. And I think that's also... the movies do this dangerous thing of kind of flirting with the idea that she has control and autonomy, that she stands up for herself, and so you could, like, make the argument of, well, in this scene, and this scene, and this scene, she puts her foot down. But it gets glazed over very quickly, and before, like, kind of what you were talking about, the cycle of abuse, she's right back in it, like, 5 minutes later. Like, she gets mad for a nanosecond.
Well, it's like the thing where her actions don't, she doesn't follow through.
No.
Because she doesn't have autonomy.
And she doesn't have... belief that she can have autonomy.
Exactly.
Should we move on? Anyone else have anything before we move on to treatment portion? There's so much in these movies that we could go on and on and on about.
Yeah, agreed. No, I think.
No, I think we can cover treatment. With these characters, we a couple things that we would want to cover. But the first thing I want to highlight is, I know I've said it a couple times, but just because someone is involved in kink or BDSM or has different sexual preferences does not mean they have anything wrong with them. It does not mean that they need treatment of any kind.
Or, like, that they like her. hurting people in this very gross, predatory way.
Right. It is oftentimes, it is a lifestyle choice. It is a whole culture. It has got its own set of rules and cultural guidelines and expectations, and it also has degrees. It exists on a spectrum. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not into one thing and then all into it. Like, some people could be into soft bondage with ties or soft, where other people could be involved in, like, enjoy being suspended and tied up by ropes and have individual body parts sectioned off by rope. Like, it just depends. Yeah. There's lots of things that people are involved in that they could be doing that can all be considered normal as long as it's consensual. And that, as long as it hits consensual, safe, smart, and what's the other one we want to
say? Sane.
Sane.
And I would say these movies demolish all three of those.
Yeah.
Yes. But yeah, I don't, like, make sure I highlight that just because you don't have that does not mean that you need treatment.
Yeah.
But given what, like, we'll talk about Anna, like, some of the things that for her that I think would have been helpful, like, number one would have been some sort of group experiment, like, group situation. I think, like, having some sort of support group for going through this or some kind of guidance to, like...
Or just, like, there's so many mentorship. Mixers and sex stores do, like, adult stores do, like, workshops that are BDSM related or, like, meetup communities, stuff like that.
Right.
Would help her normalize or understand what's normal within the community.
Right. And I think, like, that's an important, it would have been an important introduction. Also, there are lots of, like, staged scenes. There's lots of productions. There's BDSM clubs that exist. There's some in Chicago, like, that exist where, like, you people can go and get an introduction and see, like, what exists within this world. And depending on where you go, like, it can get deeper and darker and can go, but you can have a chance to experiment and see, but also, like, talk with other people who maybe are going through the same thing to have some chance to understand what's normal, what's not, what's within the realm of okay, what's not.
Because what would have been really cool with this books and these movies is if instead of the narrative becoming this wackadoo kidnapping story with that Jack guy that we didn't even talk about in the third movie that just goes totally off the rails, Lifetime movie style. Yeah. If maybe if the story had evolved into her discovering her sexuality, what scenarios she liked, what parts of the BDSM community she liked, and, like, we watched sort of the journey of her and Christian together evolving and developing into a better, healthier sexuality with each other. That would have been awesome.
Right. And that would have been, like, more realistic and fair. Like,
sexually empowering and would have made these beginning bullshit parts of the relationship not justified, but it would have made the story make more sense. And it would have kind of been a more of a story of this is where it can start sometimes in an unhealthy relationship, and this is where it can go if you do this, this, and this, and you honor this, this, and this about each other.
Yeah.
Right. And you can make sure that people have an education. I mean, he encouraged her to do some research on stuff, and she did, but...
She, like, Googled for, like, 5 minutes.
Right. Like,
and she's like, I get it.
Right. Yeah, so in this book that I mentioned earlier, one of the really cool things that I liked about it is that it's basically, she suggests that reading, doing any kind of reading, looking up, like, what terms mean, or looking up and watching different kinds of porn and trying to see what really connects to you, what feels like it would be okay. Also in the book are all different kinds of fictional erotica stories that have different scenes, I would say. And so, like, and when you read them, it's like, oh yeah, this one I feel like connected to, and this one I don't really. The other really cool thing is that it has stamping your passport at the end of almost every chapter, and it has different things that you can try or do to get more information if you're interested in it. So, like, one of the things is make a yes, maybe, no list, or practicing saying no and yes, which are just small things that you can try with your partner if you're interested in learning more about the BDSM community instead of this monstrosity that Anna and Christian
do. And you can argue they do the soft limit, hard limit thing in the beginning, but they never revisit it and it's never really put into practice. All the stuff they talk about where you could, like, throw the movie a little bit of a bone for including, they don't actually show it in practice once we're at that part of their story. Which is where it really goes wrong. Because that's where you really understand and see how to do this in a healthy way.
Right.
Yeah.
So for Anna, what else would we want to see? Like, I mean, personally, if if she came into my office, one of the things that I would want to be doing with her, honestly, is more person-centered work.
For sure.
Like, I would be, when we say person-centered, person-centered is based in the Carl Rogers theory, where it comes out of the belief that, you know, people are doing the best that they can with the information that they have available and will grow as best they can in that environment, grow and develop, and that people know themselves best and that they are the expert on what they need and where they need to go. So your job is to help use reflective listening and guidance and validation so that you let the client self-direct the session where it needs to go. And you don't do a lot of confronting and interjecting. It would be more exploration and Socratic questioning of, like, well, how did that make you feel? Or, like, you would hear some of those questions that are stereotypical therapists, but in used correctly and not just like, well, how'd that make you feel? How'd that make you feel? Like, I wonder how that experience was for you. And you make people, like, sit in the mm-hmm. thought for a minute and reflect it and go through it rather than the quick, you know, back and forth dialogue you typically see represented in movies. Like, when you're with an actual client, like, there can be use of silence where you ask the question, you know, this client a question, and then you sit with them and let them
ruminate.
Ponder on it and ruminate and really kind of start to break down and sit in it, or you use reflective listening to reflect back to point maybe in a different way, sometimes deliberately changing some of the words so that you can try to make them impact the client a little bit differently in how they think and how they're considering it. But it is largely based in helping someone have a healthy, safe place to explore their thoughts in their way, in the ways mm-hmm. that they need to. And with her, that would probably be the first place I would start, because I can see that as being also a way to gently confront some of the situations she encounters that are representative of unsafe boundaries.
And also because in this whole series, she's constantly being told by other people who she is, what she likes, what she doesn't like, what she should have, what car she should own, how much money she should do, if she should work. And I think what you're saying is a way for her to actually have to think about, what do I actually want? And not get answers from you. Because a therapist's job isn't to be another person who's, like, telling you what to do.
Right.
Right. Right. And I also
help you figure out what you need to do and what you actually want.
Right, and I also think even borrowing some concepts from Gestalt with her would be helpful to help her doing, like, understanding body work and understanding, like, blending mindfulness into that of understanding, like, how does your body feel when this mm-hmm. is happening? And I feel like Gestalt means is, like, taking the whole picture, the whole universe, like, that you're encountering, your whole self, not just a part of it. And with her experience, I feel like that's something that does not get covered at all with her. And mm-hmm. if she were my client, I would want her to understand and be aware, like, what is going on with your body? What is going on yeah. with how you feel as a social being? How you feel you fit into the world? What this does to your self-concept? And how this makes you feel physically, emotionally, and in your soul? Like, what is it that makes this connect to your reality? And those are the things that I would want to do if I had her.
Cool. How would you approach them?
So, I thought about it a little bit differently. I thought about Christian and his family, and mm-hmm. how there is a lot of secret keeping, and that happens a lot of times in families, just in general, but that helping him be able to, because he would have to do his own work, clearly, like, mm-hmm. regardless, he would have to do his own work, but having them as a family and helping him have a safe place to be able to connect, reconnect with his family and to really build and to not mm-hmm. have to continue to have secrets, that would be something that I would want to have, because I think that helping his family could also help him mm-hmm. get more comfortable with having healthy relationships in all different areas of his life. Because he also, if you notice, and this is kind of going back, but his mom also just shows up at his house. Like, yeah. I think there's some issues yeah. with boundaries in their family to begin with. And I think that trying to do that probably after some individual work is done with Anna and Christian, and then having them come together as a family and really trying to help the dynamics in the family shift, and mm-hmm. realizing that it can be a safe place and that secrets don't have to be kept.
Especially once the mom knows about the Mrs. Robinson relationship.
Yes.
Because that probably was a really big part, I would imagine, of... Well, it seems like Christian was always kind of not super attached to his mom and telling her stuff, but I'm sure the Mrs. Robinson relationship really deepened that divide, because a huge secret with Absolutely. Her friend. And so I think doing the family work after that would be really beneficial, because now all the secrets are out, mm-hmm. and so let's just get into it.
Right.
And how do we rebuild through that?
And because how do you have a healthy relationship after that with your family, with your mother? Like, I don't know how that would have made her feel. I mean, clearly in the movie she's upset, but that's a lot of, there's a lot of stuff going on there. Like, she adopts this child and he's four and she brings him into her house and her friend abuses him and he keeps it a secret for his whole life. Like, he's 27 years old.
Right.
So anyway, that's part of what I would want to try and do as a therapist. Couple-wise, I don't know, but
that's
family,
a whole thing.
Couple is a whole thing that we don't have time for. But the family, I would really be interested in the family work, especially because, as we find out in the third movie, homegirl's pregnant, and now he's going to have to make his own family. And how is he going to make his own family without having to have all of these secrets?
Well, and we didn't even touch upon when she tells him she's pregnant, he flips the fuck out. Walks out, talks to Mrs. Robinson about it, so their relationship's still pretty enmeshed. So I think a big part of that family work would be, what does he get with his relationship with Mrs. Robinson that he can't find with his mother or with Anna or with his sister or another friend or family member in his life? Why is that woman the only safe space for him?
Because she's not a safe space.
And how to reframe that with she is. Yeah. Someone healthy in his life.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think it would be hugely important, like, if we had them as a couple, if they presented, it would be huge to talk about the negotiation of boundaries and how they can be healthily represented in, and they would need to work on communication, and frankly, Christian would need to do quite a bit of work in the listening department and learning reflective
listening. He doesn't listen to her, he shuts down, he runs away, and I think a big part of it, too, is what do you want, expect from your partner to make you feel fulfilled in your relationship? And being very, like, create a list of exact behaviors, expectations you have of a partner to feel okay in your relationship. Or what you're allowed to ask of your partner that they should be okay giving to you. And then you come back together, you go over those lists together with your therapist, and you kind of decide what you can do, what you can't do, what you might be able to do if you do some more talking about it.
Yeah.
And what
I think that it would be, there would be a lot of work that would have to be done. And I think that I really feel like individually some work would have to be done before they could even come into a couple situation, to be honest. I don't know that.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure if they could just go right into couple. I think if this couple came into my office, I think it would be one of those things of, like, I'm going to see you guys individually and then we'll talk about doing couple, but it might have to start out with you both doing individual first, seeing me sometimes, and then, like, kind of going from there. It would have to be something that was really kind of structured because of all of the trauma that he's endured. And
right. And sometimes when we recommend clients for couples therapy, we may recommend that people also simultaneously seek individual treatment or suspend couples therapy entirely for individual treatment to be taken care of, because sometimes people have issues that have gotten in the way, diagnoses or symptoms that could prevent couples work from advancing.
Yes.
And you may need to work on that. And for Christian, some of his trauma would be something, if I had him, I would for sure want to go through EMDR with him, especially, like, I imagine that image of being alone with his mother who OD'd, and he said he was with her for, like, 4 days.
Yeah.
Like, there is almost 0% chance that that would not have serious, serious repercussions on his psyche. Like, he would dealing with that, and that those images and that sense of fear and that, like, a four-year-old being abandoned and not knowing what to do, no food, no water, like, mom dead, like, that's that would need a lot of work. And also, like, the we need to do some cognitive restructuring around the way he thinks about things, but with, like, the relationship that he got morphed into with Mrs. Robinson, and there's probably some pretty substantial things to work through with his sense of identity, being adopted and brought into this family. Like, we don't know much about the dynamics. It seems like his adoptive family was very loving and inclusive to him, but we also know that he had some serious behavior issues, and that the only way his violence got cured was by getting abused, and
for her siphoning it into sexuality.
Right. And she, Mrs. Robinson, defended that, and that, like, that bothered me to my core. But if she gaslighted and brainwashed him into believing that that was true, that the only way that he could stop having these violent impulses was to turn them into this controlled sexual environment, which is something that she flatly said, that, you know, like, the only way he can be reined in or kept sane is by kept safe is by doing this controlled violence, and you don't understand that. That's the only way he can be. And
well, Benjamin, you've kind of stolen my answer.
I'm sorry.
But I will, but I will continue. Because I kind of approached it, I know we're all general practitioners, but I, like, as sort of like the child therapist in the room, thought, okay, so what would happen if I got Christian? Let's say I created a scenario for myself where, let's say at 15, the relationship with Miss Robinson became known. And then his mom was like, we're getting his ass into therapy because this is horrible. So I was like, what would I do with a 15-year-old Christian? Because one, he'd probably be really reluctant. So it'd probably be a lot of just us sitting in front of each other until he got comfortable that I'm not going to do anything to him. I mean, I honestly might argue that he would should see a male therapist with, you know, after the Miss Robinson thing.
Absolutely.
I think that's true. And that I probably would do what we call TFCBT, which is trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, which is kind of what you talked about, Ben, which is cognitive restructuring, which is a fancy way of saying changing up your thoughts. And what TFCBT does is, well, first you learn coping skills, so deep breathing, like being able to calm yourself down, if you need to use squeeze balls, if you need to do like a safe place in your head, like a beach or something. And then the next part is really talking about what happened to you. And which could, with him, could go all the way back to being a little kid. Or it could just be talking about his relationship with Miss Robinson. Like, what actually did that look like? What was his story? Like, sometimes you do what we call writing out your narrative, your trauma narrative, which is exactly how it sounds. Like, just doing almost just like writing the story, a memoir of what happened, what your trauma was. And so that would be an interesting way to see how he thought of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then doing a lot of work with reframing what had happened to him. Because a lot of times when you work with people in sexually abusive relationships or power dynamic relationships like this, she probably did a lot of telling him, you are also an adult in this relationship. Our relationship is consensual. It's positive. Look at what I'm doing. Don't you feel good? And so it probably would be a lot of what she did to you was abuse and really, really affirming that over and over with him. Like, what she did was not okay. And then kind of saying, well, what does real relationships look like? Were you consensual? What maybe didn't you like or did like? Like, what? And that's also why it'd be good to do with a man, because you probably have to talk about a lot of sexual stuff, which would be a kind of, at his age, kind of inappropriate to do with a woman, especially after his trauma. And so, and saying, like, what, when you really think about it, like, did you say yes to this? Or why did you say yes? And reframing the whole narrative for him, and then maybe having him do his trauma narrative again and seeing what it looks like at that point.
Yeah.
And sometimes with kids, writing the story can be a little too intense, so you'll do more like what books reminded you of what happened to you, what movies, like bibliotherapy, or like comic strips, like you can get, or drawings, you can get really creative with how a kid or teenager, even adult, like recreates their trauma narrative, like how they display it. And then, I mean, a lot of when I've worked with kids who have been sexually abused, a thing that gets, or even adults, a thing that gets, is really hard is they felt aroused during these situations. And they might have orgasmed, even though they were being preyed upon, because your body naturally might react to the situation. So there's a lot of shame with that, or a lot of confusion, because, well, I liked it because I orgasmed, or if, or I felt aroused, or I got hard. And so restructuring for him that that's okay that that happened, that doesn't mean that you consented, that doesn't mean that you're a bad person because you enjoyed this bad thing that happened to you, and also kind of separating your sexuality from that experience, because I think that's what happened with Christian, was his sexuality got totally enmeshed with this violence.
Yeah.
And so he thought that the only way I can feel sexual is to have this violence
and involved. Consistently, maybe 5 years.
Yeah.
For 5 years.
And a very, in the part of your life when you're developing your
control
of
his
identity.
Yeah.
And that's a very pivotal time of creating what you, figuring out like your sexual identity and what you like. And do you like girls or boys? And how do you like it? And da 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 da. And so affirming his sexuality, telling him all that stuff's okay, but then kind of exploring with him, but what do you wish would have happened? Or what do you think you'd really like? Or, but doing it in an appropriate way. Like, there's a lot of workbooks that you can do with them so that it's very more sterile and not sexy as they're talking to with their therapist, that it has more of the boundaries of, we don't have to get into semantics of, like, how you like it and positions and stuff, because that's where it gets inappropriate, but more like, do you, is it okay when someone hugs you? Is it okay if when you hug someone else? Like, when I've worked even with little kids, like 6, 7, 8 year olds that have been sexually abused, and then they have sexual acting out behaviors because their arousal and their sexuality are already so confused at that age, because they already learned that when you touch them there, it feels good, even if it was a bad situation. So you do a lot of work with, where is it okay to be sexual? In your room, you can touch yourself, but not in the living room. By yourself, not with other people around. It's not okay for other people to touch you if you didn't say they could. Or they can touch you on your chest, but not your bathing suit area. Like, it's a lot of really concrete sexual intimate boundaries. And you can do it with even little kids, and I think that really wigs out adults. It really wigs out parents I've worked with, because they just kind of want it all to go away because they're traumatized by what happened to their kid.
Well, they're heartbroken.
And they're like, yeah. And all this sexual stuff is bad. But I'm like, but here's the thing. The horse is out of the barn in terms of sexuality. So how are we going to put it in a safe space now and create safe boundaries with it? And if you put it at the kid's level and you do it in a very structured way, like worksheets and things like that, a kid can get it, and it isn't sexual when you do it with a therapist. But like I said, with him, you really would probably want to do it with a male therapist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For 100%, for sure. And then you probably have to do a lot of work with the parent, psychoeducation with the parent, and that why you're doing what you're doing with the parent, so that they don't wig out if the kid brings home a worksheet or talks about something you taught them, and they're like, why are you teaching my kid about masturbating? That's not what we do, but that can be how it can be misconstrued.
Yeah.
Right.
And I'm teaching them how to be sexually safe and to be appropriate with their sexuality, because they're doing it anyway. So let's talk about how to do it in a way that's okay.
And I think that's hugely important. And then, like, if we were to get Christian as an adult, something that else that I thought of as we were going through this is that we need anger management therapy for him. Like, flat out, he needs to learn to understand.
He needs to regulate his emotional state.
Right. He needs to learn to regulate those emotions, but he also needs, we need to break the cognitive barriers that exist for him that have been installed in him, that anger is synonymous with violence, that you cannot, yeah, that he can't handle or control his anger. The only way he can do it is by being in this extremely controlled environment.
He's to push her away, or run away, or
right.
I can't be with anybody.
Right, or I have to be in this state where, like,
I'm on a mountain cliff.
I get out my anger by doing these controlled things where I'm sexually violent with women, and that's okay. Like, that's the way I control my anger.
Because they signed a contract, so we all good.
Right. And
yikes.
We need to do a lot of cognitive behavioral work with him on learning to restructure his thoughts and deal with the automatic negative thoughts, and at this point order core beliefs of him that his anger is bad, that he's damaged, that he can't control or contain his anger without doing it in these, like, set controlled ways, and if he can't have it in that space, then he's likely to explode in danger, and he's probably been thinking that he's a bad kid and this is the only thing that can save him, and that's just not true.
Which is why I do the sexual reframing with kids who've been sexually abused, is that there's all this shame and secrets and guilt and weirdness with their family about their body and their sexuality because of the abuse that happened.
Yeah.
And so we don't need to continue to shame them by not talking about it.
Right.
Like, building it up as a positive, because so that they don't do the stuff he does as an adult. Or think he has to do it in that space. I mean, me and Hannah were talking about, like, what would this movie look like if he wasn't rich and handsome? Like, would he be a predator in a more nefarious context? You know, would he be really hurting women? And then, you know, I mean, I don't want to, like, really vilify him that way. But, I mean, a lot of his behavior is excused because of his resources and his attractiveness. And so, if he didn't have that, maybe, he would be doing something more dangerous.
Who's top? He's allowed to do whatever the fuck he wants, and nobody's gonna say anything.
All right. So, have we exhausted?
I think we have. I think we have.
So, I mean, I think one thing left to say is all of us aren't individually, like, in our private lives, part of the BDSM community. All we've learned is via other people and secondary resources stuff. So if anybody out there listening is part of it and we've misspoke about something, or you like something we said, or you wanted to inform us and educate us about something, we have a email, popcornpsychology@gmail.com, or any other questions people might have. We also have an Instagram, popcornpsychology. So check us out.
Yeah, and by all means, if there's something that you have questions about, therapy that we mentioned, any jargon that we used, please let us know. We'll be happy to answer any questions. And also, if you have any suggestions or things you'd like to hear us talk about, We are happy to take suggestions. We actually received our first one this week, and one of our upcoming episodes will be taking a look at examining the differences between the different Jokers in the Batman series.
We hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be back in 2 weeks.